This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Getting hot in here.
Remember that song?
Don't give Rick any.
Like I said, the next line, I thought, nah.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who is not getting cancer from his cell phone because he never uses it, Rick S.
Hey, Mike. See, you give me a hard time. Everybody's like, Rick, was your box always full? Boom, baby. I'm going to outlive all you cancer-ridden peoples.
And I have to say, Rick is definitely not giving in to the smartphone craze.
That's true. I got my little concrete block. But, you know, but the problem is, under healthcare reform, you may be going earlier, but I'm going to be stuck paying for all of y'all's cancer treatments. How fair is that?
Yeah, that's true.
If you use a cell phone, you ought to be ineligible for healthcare coverage.
You know where I read news about this cell phone problem?
Where?
On my cell phone.
Oh, there's a bitter irony there.
It is.
Now, is it just a cancer if you're holding up to your head, or is it cancer like when it's in your pocket? What's the story?
I don't know, but that does make me a little bit nervous since I do always walk around with it in my front pocket. I can't take it out right now. Okay, no, I don't have it. Yikes.
I mean, is it just when it's actually transmitting and receiving? And do those iPhones, are they always transmitting and receiving?
They are, supposedly, right? They're tracking your location.
Your every move.
Your every
so
move.
my little chunk of concrete, maybe I'm okay?
You're almost surely okay. Why do you even carry the thing? You never answer it, and your voicemail box is always full.
I don't like talking into cell phones. It's not the same as talking into my landline. I still have a landline.
But you do call back. So what you must do is it rings, you don't answer it, but then you see who calls, and then maybe you call them back.
Well, I don't like to be interrupted doing something. So if I'm talking to someone, I hate those people who look down, and they start doing their little thumb thing.
Sure. That's fair. I got that.
Rick's cell phone's really like a pager.
Yeah.
It's
Rick's, that's exactly right. And when he says he doesn't like to be interrupted doing something, that certainly includes things like sitting at the beach,
right.
You know,
at the bar,
taking in the scene.
Reading. Yeah. Some people let their phone, every time the phone rings, they interrupt their reading. I'm like, what's up with that?
All right. Well, we've got too much to cover to keep up this wonderful conversation, Rick. Mm. We're going to play Part in the Gadfly. We got Amber's Research Minute. We got Chris's What's Up With That? Daniela, let's get started. Let's play Part in the Gadfly.
Okay. Question number one. Clark County Superintendent Dwight Jones rolled out an ambitious blueprint for the district's schools last Thursday. What are its major tenets, and what will they mean for education reform in Southern Nevada?
It's a blueprint with Rick's fingerprints.
Hi.
So, Rick, are you not Dwight Jones's policy advisor? And did you not help him with this plan in some way?
Not really. You know, I'm out there.
Honest.
No, not really. I mean, actually, if you read my engagement with the district, it says nothing that I actually suggest has any actual import. It's just there. It's advice for the, you know, superintendent to take or leave as he sees fit.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is them. I mean, I think it's neat, though. You know, Dwight was the guy who was Colorado superintendent when they pushed through 191, when everybody thought that they were the state along with Louisiana that got most shafted and raised to the top because some of what they were doing that was really cool. If folks recall, last fall, he was hired by Clark County, which people don't necessarily know this. Las Vegas actually is home to the nation's fifth biggest school district, 300,000-odd kids in Clark County. And they went ahead and they managed to convince Dwight to head down there. He took over, you know, late December. And so this is really his first vision. He's calling it phase one of his reform agenda. And, you know, he's pushing for, you know, value-added assessment as part of teacher evaluation, which is a dramatic change from the way they've done business. He's talking about looking at bang for the buck as with the way they're looking at programs and a school performance. He's talking about trying to expand earned school autonomy. So for me, I mean, it's really the, you know, he's pushing the right themes.
You know, a cynic would say somebody who may have ridden spinning wheels many years ago, that none of this really matters because Dwight Jones isn't going to be here to see this through, that, you know, these superintendents come and go, and he'll put out this reform plan, he'll start to implement it, it'll get some bite, and then he'll get run out of town by angry teacher unions or other people. I mean, is there any reason to believe that that someone like Dwight could stick it out for the long term? Or what's the governance structure in Clark County?
It's, you know, it's conventional. It's a school board, you know, made the hiring decision. They actually had an election right after they made the hiring. But the board seems behind them. You know, what's neat about Vegas is, right, the staying power of these guys often, it's often how much the community is really going to stand up. So in Boston, it was Menino and the civic community standing behind Paysan. In Chicago, it was the fact that the, you know, local community was behind the mayor when he was standing, you know, backing Duncan. You know, the thing is, there's all of this huge gaming money that's been on the sidelines in Vegas for 20 years. Well, the city has blown up in size, and it's had nothing to get engaged behind when it comes to schools. So you got Andre Agassi's down there running his own charter school. You've got, you know, Elaine Wynn with the Wynn Casino. You got these. So the interesting thing, I think, for me is going to be how actively this community winds up getting behind Jones and the effort. And if they do get engaged, I think he could be in there for a real good run.
Okay. Topic number two.
Okay. For profit firms that provide cost saving tips and support to district special education programs like Futures Education are starting to pop up. What are the promises and pitfalls of programs such as these?
Well, I am excited about this. I've been trying to talk to people about and ask questions. You know, why haven't we seen more companies in the sort of unbundling, customized schooling realm that go after the special ed services piece? You know, Rick, you've argued for a long time that we think about these whole school providers, the KIPPs or the Achievement First, to try to do the whole picture. But where it's really exciting is get these groups that can come in and really tackle one tough problem at a time. Special ed, huge challenge, also huge cost driver. And so to be able to say to a company, hey, you know, if you can come in and help us find efficiencies, you will get some of that back. And so there's a real motive for you to do so. Seems very promising. And so there was a great Ed Week article about this place, Futures. There's a couple other firms we know about also up in Massachusetts, where this is one of the highest spending states on special ed. Seems like this has a lot of promise. But here's a question, Rick. How do you make sure that you don't have shady operators coming in who try to make money by just basically denying special ed kids services? I mean, how do you get the incentives right?
Yeah, I mean, this is right the exact same thing we saw with, like, HMOs, right, when we tried them. Right, how do you actually make sure that you – and this is the problem with, right, the whole Medicare reform debate is, look, at the end of the day, probably a bunch of kids are being identified who shouldn't be identified.
Mm-hmm. Or getting services they don't really need.
That they don't really need. And we say, on the one hand, well, that's – A, it's a waste of money. And B, it's actually labeling and marginalizing these kids in a way that's probably not helpful. Mm-hmm. But as soon as somebody starts to deny a point of service, then you get parents who start to raise a fuss and even, you know, take legal action, mm-hmm. saying their kid's been denied.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no good answers. And the reality, of course, is that if you're bringing for-profit providers to do this, they actually, right, districts are going to tend to be accommodating just because their incentives encourage them to, like, want to minimize the amount of fuss and trouble. Mm-hmm. So when push comes to shove, often districts will be like, what the hell? We'll take the money out of the general ed population. Mm-hmm. We'll deal with it. And when push comes to shove, for-profit providers actually have incentive to dig in. And we tend not to make a fuss when districts give in, and we tend to make a fuss when for-profit providers dig in. Mm-hmm. And until we start to get more serious and mature about it, you know, that's just going to be the dynamic.
And the thing that these providers have that traditional districts don't is that it's easier for them to do flexible scheduling, you know, so in fact, flexible staffing. I mean, they can figure out in a given time how many speech therapists they need, for example. And so, you know, and those people don't have to be unionized, and they can be, you know, kind of private contractors. So whereas a school district might say, well, we've got 10 speech therapists on staff, and therefore we're going to try to keep them busy because we're paying for them. You know, these private contractors might say, look, we don't need as much speech therapy as we're giving out right now. Or, you know, this kid, you know, we're giving it to them because we don't have anything else for Mrs. Smith to do. They can recoup some of those savings.
Absolutely. You know, the other thing is you look at a place like DCPS with all the private school outplacement because you can't serve. I mean, if you're looking at paying 50 or 75 grand or more, you know, for some of these outplacements.
To private schools.
You know, actually, right, if you can actually bring in heavy lifting capacity to handle this stuff, even for 20, 30 grand, mm-hmm. the district's way ahead.
Yeah.
But if you actually then try to pay these folks on that comp rather than the traditional special ed, then there's going to be a fuss with the board and internally. So part of this is trying to figure out what are the right kind of cost and performance metrics. Mm-hmm. And most districts just don't have those kinds of, you know, aren't even on step one of that.
Okay, topic number three.
Okay. Diane Ravitch opined in the New York Times this Tuesday that turnaround schools are PR fabrications. Does her argument hold weight? And where do we go from here?
You know, her argument does hold some weight. I mean, it's true that she points to some examples that people have been touting. Then you look at the data, and, you know, I mean, it's hard to make a case that they're really fantastic schools are doing tremendously well. The problem is she goes on at the end of the article to basically lay out this defeatist attitude that says, well, you know, as long as kids are poor and coming from unstable homes, this is the best we can expect. and I think that's where I would disagree with her. But at the same thing, look, the other thing is, you know, reformers have we've boxed ourselves in this corner with our Pollyanna statements. I mean, if you do look at really high poverty schools, and you look for ones that are high achieving, you know, David Harris and others have said, look, you're talking about 1% of those schools, 2% of those schools. I mean, it's really hard to get strong achievement results with really, really poor kids. Now, mm-hmm. you can get gains. So I think, you know, are we, can we be less afraid in the school reform movement to say, look, what would success look like? We're talking about a kid coming in from an impoverished background. And it's not the soft bigotry of low expectations to say that it may not be 100% proficiency.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be the soft bigotry of low expectations, but it is, right? I mean, as soon as you try to talk bluntly about this stuff and about the challenges, somebody in the reform community is eager to hammer you as an apologist and a defeatist,
right?
Which is how we wound up in this box. Look, I mean, it's one thing to say, and I think there's a distinction here, to say turnarounds have been massively oversold, that a lot of the gains are ephemeral, right? You think about the high-flying schools, I guess maybe Ed Trust or whoever did 10 years ago. You know, when you look at those schools a couple of years later on, it turns out that very few of them continue to excel. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this, you know, comes and goes phenomenon there. Tom Loveless has talked about this with, you know, the difficulty of actually moving schools in terms of California performance. On the other hand, when people have been able to build school communities from scratch, when they've been able to take these, you know, tough to serve kids, but put them into schools where they're not trying to turn around a troubled institution, but purposefully recruiting a faculty, putting in place a curriculum. You know, there have been, to my mind, you know, hundreds of success stories which have done well and which I think have promise. But these are also harder to scale than some of the proponents want to suggest.
And hundreds is still, right.
Hundreds is still very limited, yeah.
And we don't know for sure that the kids are the same kind of kids, right? I mean, they may be poor, but they might not be as poor. They, you know, maybe their families are a little more stable or their mothers are a little better educated or whatever.
But, you know, this is, Diane's going to write what Diane's going to write. That is what it is. But this is what you, me, and Marty talked about in our EdNext piece, you know, 6 months ago, that one of the ways that reform community makes it hard on itself is by making grandiose claims. You know, Diane's piece should just be, it's hard to turn around schools. We all know this. Let's move on. But because reformers have so inflated these, you know, silly expectations as a marketing tool, this winds up playing as a big, look at that. You never thought of this kind of story.
Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. A good one this week, Rick. Very substantive. Though I'm a little disappointed you haven't made very many funny wisecracks. And that's really what our audience comes to us for.
That's what I say.
For you to say ridiculous things like talking about bench pressing Amber over your head. Those sorts of statements. Well, maybe we'll see it later in the show. Daniela, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We had to just take an air conditioning break here on the show.
A little steamy in here.
Cool down the studio.
Ooh, getting hot in here.
Remember that song? Don't give Rick any.
Like I say the next line, I thought, No.
We don't give, don't give Rick any encouragement.
I'm feeling a little harassed. Are you implying you want me to take my shirt off and wave it? I don't come over here for that kind of.
Yeah, Mike read my mind as I was about to sing the next line and gave me that look like, don't even tempt him.
Is this a hostile work environment for you, Rick?
I'm feeling a little hostilized.
Anywho.
You know, male sexual harassment of males is a really underreported phenomenon.
Yes, I know that it is. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Although I do remember there was one of those like 28, 29-year-old teachers sleeping with her 12-year-old student.
Mm-hmm.
Marianne older woman Letourneau. Teacher.
I don't remember which one. She was really good looking. Mm. And I remember Jimmy Kimmel was talking after the court verdict. He said, the woman, the teacher, was sentenced to 5 to 8 years medium security, and the boy was sentenced to high fives for life.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to laugh.
Terrible, I tell you.
Okay.
Sad truth.
Rick, you are so responsive. I ask you, come on, say some crazy, fun stuff, and boom, you come right in with it.
It's just,
these are the things that are true, and I think it's funny that we want to pretend so hard not to acknowledge them, and then we wonder why kids think we actually aren't able to communicate, like, honestly. It's weird.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
So this sounds dry, but it's actually got some interesting data points. We have the new condition of education, which just came out this week. I'll highlight a few of the more interesting data points for us to mull over. First, we see that school choice continues to make headway. The number of students enrolled in public charter schools more than tripled from 99,000 to 08-09, from 340,000 to 1.4 million. So now we've got roughly 5% of all public schools as charter schools, compared to 1% 10 years ago. We sort of know that. But another little factoid, private school enrollment fell from a high of 6.3 million students in 01-02 to 5.5 million last year. Further, private schools enrolled about 10% of elementary and secondary students in 9-10, down from a high of 12% a few years earlier. So apparently Catholic schools and conservative Christian schools are posting large numbers in terms of declines. During the same time, public school enrollment is increasing by about 2.1 million students to 40. Now we've got about almost 50 million from 01 to 09. We also have a couple interesting factoids about post-secondary education. Undergraduate enrollment.
Ooh, this is fun so
This
far.
Is fun. Increased by 4.4
this is
million.
It's almost as good as you know, hot teachers sleeping with their 12-year-old students.
I continue. For-profit degree programs had a big spike, about 27% increase in for-profit degree programs.
I feel like it's back, like in June, back in high school. This is how I remember feeling.
All right, I'm going to end on a really high note. I'm not even going to tell you. This is also interesting. The geeks around the table, of which I'm the only one. Five fields had most of the bachelor's degree. What do you guys think most kids graduate in?
Psychology.
That came in last. What are the other four?
That came in. That was not.
Last five. Of the five,
yeah,
right?
Thank
yeah.
you.
Psychology.
Education.
Yep. Come on, everybody's got this. My significant other's getting one.
English.
Business. MBA.
Business.
Anywho.
Not MBA. No, no. The
well, business. Yeah. Health. Yeah, health is the other one. Psychology. Like, who? What do you do with a psychology degree? Anyway, finally, total expenditures per student obviously continues to rise. But guess what? This is interesting. I know you'll agree. What do you think was the highest increase? Not current expenditures, not employee benefits. What do you think really went up?
Wow. If you were around a table and you could show this, it would still be dull.
Interest
but doing this over the radio, people are going to be bored out of their minds.
Interest on school debt. Huh? What do you think about that?
It went way up high.
105%. Yeah, increase. We're paying more per student. Went from $159 to $326.
All right.
That's a big deal.
That is interesting.
That is a big
deal. We are spending a lot of money.
You know, I got to say, Ams, I think a better technique for rattling off lots of stats like this is to ask a couple of questions and then tease them and be like, you know.
All right, I'll try that.
You can go online and find it. So people go, ooh, where might I learn
this? Did I not try to do that when I said, what five professions do you think kids graduate in?
That worked
better. That was engaging.
You know, on the psychology major question, I do remember there was a girl freshman year in college. And this is when psychology is useful. I remember one of my friends, he's bummed. I think he broke up with his girlfriend. And she said, you can always talk to me. I'm a psych major.
That's awesome. That's great. Did she get all Freudian on him?
No, I think it was actually a way she was trying to, hook up. Mm-hmm. I think it was, but it's a strategy.
Since public charter schools are gaining students and private schools are losing them, we have With or Without You by U2.
Song selection was that it's also U2 and it's a Catholic band, and so it kind of fit in with the Catholic schools thing.
Nice. And it's also got a guy named The Edge.
Yes.
And when you look at a financial spreadsheet,
mm-hmm.
there's some kind of like technical term, the edge.
No, no. What you want to say is Catholic school enrollment is going over the edge.
Oh.
Don't All be right. such a Bono.
Ba-dum-bum.
Okay, it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir.
Chris, welcome to the show.
How's it going?
Good. Rick has a question for you.
Chris. What's up with that, baby?
Well, I'll tell you, Rick. What I've got this week is by no means news to the residents of Metro Dallas, but it is once again rising to the headlines. In the wake of a $25 billion budget shortfall in Texas, Allen High School, a suburb of Dallas, is moving forward with its plans to construct an 18,000-seat state-of-the-art football stadium costing over $60 million. The current stadium, with a capacity of 14,000, has been the home to the Allen Eagles and their marching band, the biggest in the country, since 1976. Many national education pundits are enraged that while tens of thousands of Texas teachers are losing their jobs, the folks in Allen are continuing to drop millions into a sporting complex. What's up with that? I find it funny how all of these know-it-alls complaining about this being such a poor use of money don't actually know their arses from their elbows. Maybe these people should take a break from blogging and tweeting their condemnation every minute of the day so they can learn a little bit about how bond issues work. It's not like this money is coming from some all-purpose lockbox of cash that could have been used to keep teachers from being laid off. In 2009, the residents of Allen voted, almost 2-1, in favor of a $119 million bond that would provide a new auditorium for the fine arts and a new service center for the school district, not just a football stadium. And never mind the revenue that the stadium will generate, much of which will in turn becomes general funding for the school as a whole. High school football is not just a sport in Texas, it's a part of the culture. So before we go judging other people's expenditures, let's all take a deep breath and consider that we might be insulting more than just their spending habits.
Wow. You know, the thing I love about this segment is I never really know where Chris is going with it.
Never.
I mean, I just didn't know where and he surprises me. I like that. It's unpredictable. So, I don't know how this works. In Texas, like, okay, so 18,000 people show up for a football game. Are they paying admission? I mean,
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then that money can go into the school district coffers?
That's probably true even in Montgomery County, Mike.
Yeah?
You just don't go to football games.
No, anymore. I'm trying to remember back from high school if we, I guess.
But you were like the mascot, right?
No, I was on the soccer team.
Oh, I know something. So yeah, they don't charge you when you're playing.
Right. Oh, that's good. That's why I don't remember it.
And they don't really charge to watch soccer, but football.
They did charge to watch football.
Yeah, and then they remember, like the auxiliary will set up, and there's also hot chocolate and popcorn.
I remember. Sure.
So yeah. It'll take a little while to make $60 million back, I suspect.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
They play six games a year. Even if you buy a lot of popcorn, it's probably still not more than $4 or $6 a person.
Mm-hmm.
And this, by the way, will only be the fifth largest stadium, high school stadium, in the state of Texas.
There's a Texas football high school arms race.
Yes. All right. Well, so what do we say? We just say, you know what, Texas, have your football stadium if you want it. It's okay. It's okay with us. You know, those teachers that get laid off, maybe they can go work as ushers or something at the stadium.
Hey, doing more with less.
Okay, that's all the time we got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Kiss.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.